Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we meet a young country music artist who's looking to the 90s for inspiration.
And a life-changing trip to Bisbee.
But first, it used to be that federal immigration agents were told to avoid places like schools, hospitals, and churches. Certain places were sort of sacred. But the Department of Homeland Security rescinded that memo on the day of President Donald Trump's inauguration. Now schools are preparing for ICE activity. As the new school year has gotten underway, we've already seen reports of families arrested by immigration agents walking their kids to school. ABC 15 released a video of an ICE agent walking a kid to school in South Phoenix, advocates say, after his parents had been detained. Well, our next guest says even the fear of ICE on school campuses is causing real harm already. While his name has been in the headlines of late for questions about the finances of the Tolleson Union High School District, Superintendent Jeremy Calles came into our studios to talk about how his heavily Latino district is working to protect students in this environment.
I'm seeing more fear I am actual activity. It's more of a fear of activity. We're a growing district. We're actually in the process of building a new school right now. We are projected to have continued growth, and we saw decline this year. We've reached out to some of the families, and some of the families have left the country. Some of the families are, you know, just in fear, not sending their students to school. So we're actually declining this year, which was a shock to be declining when we're projected for so much growth.
Right.
So there's definitely a lot of fear. There's fear, you know, amongst students, amongst staff, parents, community. It's just the perception of what will happen when ICE comes. And anytime we get a rumor that there's ICE, we have, you know, everyone calling, everyone nervous. A lot of times it doesn't check out. It's like the game of telephone. It's been overhyped by the time it gets to my desk. And, you know, I'll make some calls and find out that none of that is actually happening. I mean, like, I think the ice cream truck could go by at this point. People would be nervous.
It spreads quickly on social media, right? Is that what you're seeing? People will start to see a post here or there saying, oh, there's ICE activity in this area, and you get a lot of calls.
Yes.
Wow.
And then it's the calls. It's the emails. It's mostly the fear. It's the fear factor that's hit so far.
So I want to ask about what the implications of that are, not just for the school community and, like, you know, your job trying to make sure that there's enough funding and that you calm nerves when somebody thinks that there's an ICE agent nearby or an ICE raid nearby. But I mean, what does it do to students' ability to learn?
I think it makes a severe impact. When you have problems going on that are bigger than the math problems that we're giving you, it's always a distraction. And we work hard to eliminate those distractions. For instance, you know, one that we've dealt with for a number of years is a hungry child showing up to school.
Yeah.
Well, we offer free breakfast, free lunch, free supper. Things going on at the home that make them feel unsafe. We do everything we can to make them safe at school. But now there is this new threat of ICE, and it is, how do we make them feel safe? And not just the students who, you know, may be directly impacted, but even those indirectly impacted, because you may have a good friend and you don't know if your friend is here legally or not. Like, you could be in fear for your friend. You could be in fear just seeing an officer come on campus. You know, we've dealt with things before where we had to work with police officers, and we have processes for that. I have tried to ground both staff and community to let them know, like, okay, so we have something that we've dealt with before, right? Police officers have had to at times come to our campuses. Let's start from there and then start talking about what is going to be different with ICE now, when it could be federal agents instead of a local officer that's coming to the campus.
Right. So tell us what those conversations are like. I'm sure these are legal conversations, maybe security conversations. How are you preparing for this?
Well, the toughest part is them not knowing how to respond. So the first thing that we did is we took the form that we would normally give a police officer, and we adapted that to now be able to have it ready to give to an ICE officer. The extra hurdle involved in this is that if you say the wrong thing, you personally as a school secretary, a receptionist, could be held liable and taken to jail for interfering with immigration. So what I've instructed all the staff is in the event that an ICE officer does arrive to campus, the first thing they are to do is to contact me so I can personally go talk with the officer.
So you plan to be there?
Yes. If they're there, I plan to be there. And, you know, I'll have our lawyer on the phone as I'm reviewing the warrant and seeing exactly what the warrant entitles that officer to and what type of warrant it is. But I don't want my staff to have to worry about handling that conversation and about them personally being held liable either for, you know, doing too much and violating district policy, not doing enough and violating federal policy. I'm like, I want to take that worry out of your mind so you can get focused on educating our children again. All you have to do is call me.
Yeah.
I'll come down there. I'll handle that conversation.
So you mentioned a warrant. They would have to have a warrant to come into a school at this point, as far as you can tell, legally?
Absolutely. We've worked this over with our lawyer. It would have to be a judicial warrant to get any type of access to the student. And access to the student does not necessarily mean free reign across the campus. It means access to the student.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, again, we've seen similar things on the police side of things. When police have shown up with an arrest warrant for a student, we know how to process that. And so we take what we know and then we adapt it to what's different about this situation.
What rights do you have kind of beyond the school property itself? Like, can you protect students when they're not on campus?
No, and that's the scariest part, and I think that's why we see that students haven't all returned to school. And our jurisdiction ends at our sidewalk, so we really can't do anything over there. You know, for the rumors that I have heard, the stories that I have heard, which, you know, again, I can't completely validate, but I have heard of students on their way to school and getting stopped and either their parents getting picked up or the student getting picked up. When ICE takes a parent, they give a simple piece of paper that states, we've taken the parent. The parent has put this name on a piece of paper and told us this is who's in charge of taking care of their child now.
Yeah.
Which is an issue because we need far more documentation than that to change over guardian rights in our system than just a parent getting detained has essentially tried to handwrite over guardian notes.
Were you in public education here during SB 1070?
I was. I've been in education for 20 years now.
What was it like then? Does this remind you of that?
It does. I was over in Kyrene Elementary at that time, and we didn't have as many students that were directly impacted. I'm originally from the West Valley, grew up in the West Valley, though, and yes, I'm well aware of the impact. I had plenty of stories coming back to me.
Yeah. So I wonder what you make of this moment, I guess. Like, do you think this is all about politics kind of crossing a line, or do you think that there's really something to be said here about rule of law?
No, I think politics has clearly crossed a line. You know, there's a reason why schools were considered sanctuaries. Schools are a place where students should come to be educated. It's not a place to invoke a political agenda. You know, we've had police departments before ask if they could have 24/7 access to our cameras. I've told them no. We are not your convenient place to be policing the community. Like, that type of stuff needs to happen outside the school campus. You know, our prime responsibility is that we've been entrusted with someone else's child. The one thing that we have to do is return that child to them at the end of the day.
Hmm. What would you say to someone who says, you know, these are people who are not in the country legally and the law has to rule the day? You're interfering in that, essentially.
I would tell them they have a home address. If you could figure out where they went to school, you could figure out where they live. Take care of that activity over there. You don't need to bring that to the school campus.
Where do you see this leading?
Well, I mean, considering where we're at with politics right now, I don't think we're making an abrupt change within the next 3+ years. I can imagine it is only going to get worse, and at some point they are going to believe they have free reign to breach campuses, and we're going to have to legally test that theory and see how that plays out.
All right. Jeremy Kayes, superintendent of the Tolleson Union High School District, joining us. Jeremy, thank you for coming in. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Governor Hobbs recently signed an executive order designed to expand access to COVID-19 vaccines. And given all the headlines about the federal policy changes related to the vaccine and vaccines in general, we thought it might be good to have someone come on to clarify the status of COVID vaccine access here in Arizona. So yesterday, I spoke with Dr. Sarah Coles, a physician who sits on the board of directors of the Arizona Medical Association. I asked her to explain the context for the governor's order.
So Governor Hobbs's recent executive order does two critical things, both of which are designed to try to improve access and ensure that all Arizonans can get the COVID-19 vaccine if they choose. So first, it asks the Department of Insurance and Financial Institutions to encourage their insurers and insurance companies to provide access and pay for the COVID-19 vaccine. The second big thing that it did was ask the Arizona Department of Health to issue a standing order for everybody to be able to get COVID-19 vaccines in a pharmacy without requiring a physician's prescription. So a standing order is like a blanket prescription for anybody who wants it to be able to walk into a pharmacy and get that vaccine. And that order has been issued by the Arizona Department of Health.
Okay, so safe to say that as of this moment, anybody who wants to get a COVID vaccine can go into a pharmacy and get one.
So the pharmacies are currently implementing this order right now, but in the next few days, yes, that should be the case.
Okay. I think probably some people listening to this, myself included, might have lost track of where things stood exactly prior to the executive order. What does this executive order change, and what was it issued in response to?
That's a great question. It has been very confusing, and you are not alone in feeling confused
okay,
about why this needs to happen. So Governor Hobbs issued this executive order in response to two big things that happened. So the FDA decided to change the COVID-19 vaccine eligibility recently, in which they limited access to the vaccine for people 65 years and older, and to those who have conditions that put them at highest risk. The CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, met last week and issued an entirely different recommendation from the FDA, which was narrower than their previous recommendations that they've made in the past. So the ACIP said that they now recommend vaccines for individuals with shared decision-making, meaning they recommend a discussion with your primary care doctor to talk about risks and benefits. All of these actions, both by the FDA and the ACIP, potentially limit access to that vaccine. So Governor Hobbs issued this order to try to override that and ensure that everybody can get the vaccine if they want it.
So if I'm hearing you right, basically what Governor Hobbs has done here is create a separate infrastructure within our state for people to have open access to the vaccine so that they don't have to worry about these new restrictions and guidance that have been implemented at the federal level.
Correct. So this will override both the ACIP and the FDA, allow them to get the vaccines without those restrictions, and be able to do it without having to have the burden or the hassle of having to go through your primary care doctor's office to get that vaccine. So you don't need a prescription, you don't need to make an appointment, arrange transportation, get out of work, or provide caregiving for someone else. Everybody can go to a pharmacy and get the vaccine that they need.
And is coverage of payment for the vaccine contingent on someone's insurance situation?
The good news is everybody should be able to get the vaccine covered now without out-of-pocket cost. So the Department of Health and Human Services has confirmed under the new ACIP recommendation that the COVID-19 vaccine will be covered by government insurances like Medicaid, Medicare, the Children's Health Insurance Program, commercial insurances through the Marketplace, and the Vaccines for Children program. The trade organization that represents commercial insurers has also confirmed that they will be providing the access to the vaccine without out-of-pocket cost.
Can I ask you, Dr. Coles, as a family physician, are you recommending to your patients to get the COVID vaccine?
Absolutely. I am strongly recommending that everybody ages 6 months and up get the COVID-19 vaccine, just as I have in past years. Vaccines remain our best tool to prevent infection and serious illness, like hospitalization and even death from COVID-19. This vaccine is very safe and very effective, and I myself have gotten the vaccine and encourage other people to do so.
Is there any evidence that you're aware of that suggests the vaccine can have dangerous side effects or any sort of adverse health impacts?
Every vaccine can have potential side effects. That is absolutely true. The most common side effects of the COVID-19 vaccine, similar to other vaccines, are what we call reactogenic effects. That means side effects you feel as your immune system turns on and builds antibodies to help you fight infection. So most of the symptoms we feel after getting a vaccine are our immune systems doing their job. So you can get things like fevers, sore, achy arms or muscles, feeling a little bit more run down or just kind of generally blah for a day or two after getting the vaccine. But these are expected, mild, and typically go away on their own without doing anything at all. There are some potential risks to the COVID-19 vaccine, particularly for younger men, including a risk of myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart. This is very rare and very often resolves without any intervention and has not resulted in any serious or long-term health consequences. And it's important to note that that kind of a risk, that myocarditis, is much more likely to happen if you get COVID-19 infection rather than the vaccination.
There might be, I think, some people listening to this who got one or two or maybe even three rounds of the vaccine back in 2020, 2021, 2022, but maybe have not re-upped since then. For those folks, would it be your recommendation to go ahead and go to a pharmacy and get a fresh shot?
Absolutely. I would encourage everybody to go get this year's updated COVID-19 vaccine. And the reason that we recommend it is that the COVID virus is tricky. It changes a little bit every year and mutates pretty rapidly compared to other viruses. So a vaccine that you got last year or an infection that you got in the last season is not as protective as the current vaccine.
Got it. And I was talking about this with somebody recently who said, like, oh, yes, I've been meaning to go to the pharmacy, but I can't find my vaccine card, you know, those little white cards that people were being issued when the first round of COVID vaccines came out. Do you need that card in order to get a shot?
Nope, you don't need to bring your old vaccine cards to get your shot this year.
And then last question for you, Dr. Coles. Where do things stand in terms of danger with the latest strain of COVID? I think, again, there's probably some people listening to this who maybe haven't thought very much about COVID for a year or two. What are the dangers of the current strain of COVID that people should be aware of?
It continues to cause millions of illnesses a year, hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations, and still tens of thousands of deaths every year. It is still more dangerous than the flu, for example, or the common cold. It is most dangerous for people who have chronic medical conditions like heart or lung conditions or diabetes, or older folks, people over the age of 65. But it is dangerous for potentially anyone. COVID infections can cause long-term illness that's called long COVID, and that can happen to anyone, even people who have very mild illness. And long COVID can cause really debilitating symptoms like brain fog, fatigue, trouble breathing. So COVID vaccine remains our best way to prevent this kind of serious illness and long-term consequence.
All right. Well, that is Dr. Sarah Coles, a family physician, a medical educator, and a member of the board of directors at the Arizona Medical Association. Dr. Coles, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, the unexpected resurgence of old school country music among Gen Zers.
People miss that old sound, you know. I know that it doesn't really relate to a lot of people nowadays, you know, especially my generation itself. There's not a lot of kids that are doing rodeo or not a lot of ranchers anymore.
We'll hear from one young artist who's bringing 90s country music back.
But first, Uber has agreed to a deal with two other companies, and it could lead to more autonomous vehicles on the roads. Axios reports the ride-hailing company will buy 20,000 vehicles from Lucid. They'll be made at the carmaker's facility in Casa Grande. And Nuro will provide the AV technology for the robotaxis.
The Valley has been a bit of a hotbed of autonomous vehicle activity, and to find out what all this means for the region and the industry in general, our co-host Mark Brody spoke with Joanne Muller, transportation correspondent for Axios, where she writes the Future of Mobility newsletter. They started with how big of a deal in the AV world this new deal is.
Well, I think it's a big deal for a number of reasons. Let's start with Uber, because this is a ride hailing company that really disrupted transportation 15 years ago, and now they're on the cusp of getting disrupted by autonomous vehicles and robo-taxis. And so Uber has kind of an existential threat, which is, do we try to beat them? Do we join them? What do we do? And Uber's strategy has been to partner with a lot of different AV partners around the globe, really. But in the United States, it's mostly been with Waymo up until now, and they have some Waymos on the Uber network in Austin and Atlanta. But remember that Waymo, as you know, in Phoenix, they have their own network of robo-taxis. And there's a little bit of tension there if you think about it. If Waymo were to decide, we don't really want to be on Uber network anymore, we just want to collect all the fares and the money for ourselves, that leaves Uber up a creek. And so that's a reason why they formed this partnership with Nuro. Okay, now you have to find a third partner. Who's the car company? That's Lucid in this case. Lucid is a great partner for autonomous vehicles because they are already electric. They have a ton of technology in them. They're very easy to add on autonomy. And so that's why you have this interesting three-way partnership. It's really a win for all three companies.
It's an interesting place, I think, for Uber, because their venture into autonomous vehicles has been kind of fits and starts, right? Like, they were really into it. And then, of course, they had the incident in the Phoenix area where a car hit and killed a pedestrian. They stopped doing it and they seem to be on the way back. Are they potentially still a big player in the AV world?
I believe so, yes. You're absolutely right. In the beginning, they wanted to develop the technology themselves. And that's why, they had that car in Phoenix. It was on a Volvo that killed the pedestrian. And that sort of sent a chill over the entire AV industry for a couple of years. But Uber has always known that the day would come when people are going to want to ride in autonomous vehicles, not just human-driven vehicles.
Well, when you talk about money, like, do folks who study this sort of thing seem to think that there is room for another company in the AV space? Like, Waymo, at least in Phoenix, has a pretty big foothold already in a lot of vehicles. A lot of people use them. Is there room for another company, Uber or whomever else, to come in? And can more than one company make money doing this?
Absolutely. I think you need to have more than one company. You know, right now there's really only three companies that are still in the robo-taxi business. Waymo is way ahead. Tesla is trying to get its robo-taxi service off the ground. And then you have a company called Zoox, which just launched in Las Vegas. So you've got, Waymo is owned by Google. You've got Zoox, which is owned by Amazon, and then you've got Tesla, which is another one of these giant tech firms. And so we'll have to see. There's still going to be some shakeouts and some movement. It's still very, very early days. And while Waymo is very dominant there in Phoenix, obviously they got their start there, and their service area has grown and grown. They're only in less than 10 markets nationwide in one form or another. Or let's say they've announced 10 markets. They're not even operating in all those. But it's such a minuscule part of the whole rideshare taxi business. So tons of room for growth, and it's not too late for anybody to get into this business.
So I'm wondering what all of this means for the Phoenix area, because as we've discussed, Waymo has a very strong presence here in the Phoenix area. Now, these Lucid vehicles will be built and retrofit or outfitted with the AV technology just a little bit south of the Phoenix area. Is it safe to say that this area will continue to be sort of a hotbed for this kind of activity?
I think so. This is certainly very good news for Lucid, which, as a pure EV company faces a somewhat challenging future with incentives going away, for example, tax incentives for purchasing an EV. They tend to sell, you know, higher end vehicles. They only have a couple models so far. The newest one is the Gravity. It's an SUV crossover, and that is the vehicle that will be the basis for these new robo-taxis. And the fact that, you know, that production will happen in the factory in Arizona is great because it ensures that there will continue to be jobs there. And so I do think it's good for the economy in general in Arizona. It's good for Lucid. And I think that Phoenix has surely been kind of setting the pace when it comes to the whole autonomous vehicle market.
Joanne, let me ask you about one other thing that you've written about recently, which is some data suggesting that in markets where driverless cars, taxis are available, that the amount that rideshare drivers make is going down. Phoenix, of course, one of them. Is it too simplistic to say that this is evidence that people prefer being driven by a robot as opposed to being driven by a human?
I think that's part of it, for sure. But, you know, I think the competition is relevant here, right? And it's right now, robo-taxis cannot go everywhere. And so if I were a gig driver, I'd be worried about what this portends for the future, for sure. On the other hand, I think because of the fact that robo-taxis are limited in where they can go and when they can go, that the gig driver will adapt and know that they'll just focus on highway or on airport runs, let's say, or they'll focus on those areas that are not served by robo taxis. Certainly when there's a big concert, let's say, everybody's trying to get a car at one time, the human driver is going to be better equipped to get to the customer than the robot that's going to be confused and staring, standing around trying to figure out what do I do in this traffic jam.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Joanne Muller, transportation correspondent for Axios, where she writes the Future of Mobility newsletter. Joanne, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. This weekend marks the second annual TWIB Fest in Bisbee, an all-day festival featuring local bands, food, and games. TWIB stands for This Week in Bisbee, which is the name of a radio show and newsletter started by LA transplant Steve Morimarco. Morimarco moved to Bisbee at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. He had been struggling to get his music career off the ground in L.A. for a while, and the quarantine was making him feel trapped in his studio apartment. I spoke with him recently and asked him how he ended up in Bisbee.
I was like, I got to get out of L.A., and I was trying to think where I would go, and I remembered a friend had visited Bisbee and went to Side Pony, one of our festivals here, and posted something, and I saw something about that and remembered it. And then another friend visited me in December of that year, just coming from Bisbee, saying to me, like, dude, it's like the Brooklyn of the Southwest. You've got to check it out, just sort of casually. And I was like, I just registered those things. So, you know, and I was just thinking about, you know, where I might just, you know, get away for a little bit while, you know, the world sort of took a strange turn. I didn't plan on moving here.
It's pretty amazing to me just hearing you in the story so far. You pack up, you leave LA, you get to Bisbee, and something about the place, it sounds like before too long, makes you feel like this isn't just where I'm going to hang out for a little while. This is where I'm going to put down new roots. I'm going to buy a house here. What was it about the place that made you feel that way?
That's it. I mean, we're a mile high, mm-hmm. So we're 10, 15 degrees cooler than Phoenix, temperature-wise and, you know, social-wise. I don't know. I think we're very cool town. But
I see what you did there.
Yeah. It's a magical place. Once you come through the tunnel, we call it the time tunnel. You're sort of flying in, looking, you know, on the mountain road, looking in this valley and seeing a town that's been around since 1880, you know, and a lot of it is still intact. You know, you're listening to classic rock in Tucson, then you come through and 96.1 is our station, KBRP, and then, you know, some weird, who knows what you'll hear on the station coming through.
Talk a little bit about the music scene in Bisbee as you got enmeshed in it. What kind of music were you hearing? What kind of musicians were you meeting?
Oh, man, it's amazing how many musicians and bands there are in this small town. I mean, it's so diverse. We've got like a Juniper Gin or like a jazz Americana band. We got the X-Bats are like a pop punk kind of garage band.
I know you like you like I like it. Now you know that I want it like you want it.
This band Fatigo, that's I call it like jazz pop. My band was called the Steve Moramarco Conspiracy. Now I'm just going by Moramarco.
Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar. Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar now. Hey, Satan, Satan, lend me a dollar.
At a certain point, once after you got there, you started curating this newsletter, This Week in Bisbee, which also became your radio show on KBRP.
Yeah.
What was that in reaction to? What did you feel like there was a need for something like that?
Well, basically, my drummer at the time and my bass player also were in other bands, you know, and that's sort of a feature of most of the Bisbee bands. So I sort of needed to know when they were playing in order to book my own shows. Like, so that was part of it. But I come from, you know, big city, Los Angeles, New York, San Diego. We had our LA Weekly. We had the Village Voice, the Reader. You had one central spot for all the listings.
Well, that makes sense. So like you were looking to kind of replicate this experience you'd had in bigger places where there was kind of a central repository of like, look here for all the cool stuff.
Exactly. Yep. And this was around the same time I was thinking about, you know, doing a radio show. So I just, you know, went through the training and they mentioned, you know, it would be great if someone was, you know, doing the listings. And I was like, yeah, I was, you know, going to start doing that anyway.
And is that so it's like a community radio station?
Yeah. KBRP. Yep. We are Bisbee's radio for the people.
All right. All right.
Low Amen. Power. We just celebrated our 20th year.
Cool.
Online. So we've got, it's crazy, all the things we have in this town. It does really feel like a mini Brooklyn of the Southwest or whatever. You walk down the streets and we got, you know, feels like Greenwich Village a lot with the brick facades and all that. And
Let me ask you, Steve, I mean, do you feel like it's a version of the life you were looking for back in L.A.?
Couldn't have a radio show in L.A. My band, you know, I'd be lucky to get a, you know, 45 minutes on a Tuesday at midnight or something. I didn't.
In L.A., you're saying.
But in L.A., yeah. I mean, it was just a lot. Here, you know, they're like, okay, you know, you're playing 7 to 10 p.m. You know,
right.
You got so three sets, you know. And, so I'll see your
45 minutes and raise you 3 hours.
Yeah, exactly. So it's basically, I can do my art a lot easier. Yeah. Without the rat race aspect of it. It feels like a dream when I wake up and I look around and I go to this town. This town feels like an imaginary place.
Bisbee.
brother, won't you take me by the hand? Take me to the promised land where we are free.
Well, Steve Moramarco is the host of This Week in Bisbee on the radio on KBRP 96.1 and the curator of This Week in Bisbee, the newsletter. Steve, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Come on down to Bisbee. I'll show you a good time.
Okay.
Bisbee, brother, won't you take me by the hand? Take me to the promised land where we are free. Don't know what's next, but I am here to stay. Till my dying day, eternity.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Well, 90s country music is having a moment. In fact, Gen Z has a slew of young artists who are not incorporating pop or hip hop into their country tunes, like what you might hear on country radio right now. They're bringing back the twang, steel guitar, and even line dancing rhythm. And one of them is doing it from right here in the Southwest. Zaki Sukarno is a 25-year-old American Idol alum from Las Cruces, New Mexico, who sounds more like George Strait than Jelly Roll. He told me he likes storytelling in his songs and wants to put New Mexico on the country music map.
I've always loved country music in general. You know, when I was on American Idol, I was kind of trying to figure out what my sound was back in 2020 or so.
Mm-hmm.
I've done music all my life, and country music, especially 90s country music and 60s country music, is really what I fell in love with. I knew that I wanted to leave a legacy here, just like some of the greats. And at the end of the day, I want people to hear my record or my song and, you know, think about what they experienced back in the day as well. Hmm. So that keeps going on for generations.
So you're consciously trying to make country music that does not sound like what's on country radio, it sounds like. Like, there's a lot of twang in there, and you're not really talking about, you know, beer and trucks and girls so much, right?
No, ma'am. No, I like to tell stories when I write my music itself. And I'm grateful to have some amazing writers that write with me. That want to do the exact same thing. And at the end of the day, as long as there's some steel guitar on there, maybe some fiddle, that's what I love. And, you know, it just pulls out all those emotions.
Who were your favorites growing up? Like, who did you listen to?
Ooh, one of my favorite artists growing up is actually Tracy Lawrence. So Tracy Lawrence is someone I really look up to.
This material life with all its value don't mean a thing to me without you. The love that we once had is all I need. So take everything we have if it makes you happy.
Randy Travis, Marty Robbins, George Jones, Keith Whitley, a couple other handfuls. Of course, I love George Strait as well, but a lot of those 90s and 60s country artists.
So what you're doing seems kind of like a trend right now, in a way, at least. I know it's not what you're hearing on country radio, but I mean, I've heard several kind of young artists who are doing this, and I Googled it, and sure enough, there's a lot of data here, too. Like, Spotify is reporting that Gen Z has made 89 million playlists featuring 90s country hits.
Holy, did not know that.
That's yeah, crazy. I mean, you have a song called Love Like 90s Country.
Yes, ma'am.
In all the stories we share together, I can't wait to live this life forever. Living on love, babe, like 90s country tunes. And this is something that I can't conceal. Girl, you gotta know the way you feel. A love feels like a 90s country. So check yes on.
What do you think is the pull here?
I think nowadays, I mean, people miss that old sound, you know. I know that it doesn't really relate to a lot of people nowadays, you know, especially my generation itself. There's not a lot of kids that are doing rodeo or not a lot of ranchers anymore. But a lot of the songs that I listened to growing up, I was like, holy crap, you know, this is what I'm doing in college. I'm going out to honky-tonk bars and, you know, I'm going through heartbreaks, going through love.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes a whole army. And I know a lot of us, like, you got Braxton Keith, you got Zach Top, Drake Milligan, you know, Jake Worthington.
in the state of Tennessee. He said, you must be buzzing on something, son. I said, I am, but it ain't what you're thinking of.
It's like a whole army of us are kind of just trying to push that old agenda, you know, and it's been truly amazing being a part of it so far.
That sounds cool. All right, so I want to back up for a minute or two here and talk about you and how you got here. You were born in Japan. Your parents are Indonesian, right? And then you grew up in Las Cruces in New Mexico.
I grew up as a military brat. My dad was in the military for a majority of my life. And we actually moved to New Mexico because he got stationed out there. And I fell in love with agriculture at a pretty young age. And I started helping out on my friends' farms, on their ranches, and got to know and work with some amazing animals and some crops and stuff. So that's what really got me into the ag field. And, you know, listening to country music kind of tied everything together, because when I was working all by myself, that's what I listened to. And I was like, oh, shoot, they're talking about the hardworking man. And yeah, it's been really, really fun.
So you were sort of a transplant into that world, being a military kid, as you said. What's it like being an Asian American artist in country music today?
Oh, I get some interesting looks and a lot of questions for sure, and especially folks that I know personally, you know. I mean, we go to certain events or family functions, and I meet a lot of my parents' friends who are also Indonesian. I'm like, no way you're Indonesian. Especially the way I speak and the way I dress. It throws everyone off completely. But I think it's that slight wow factor that's like, okay, that's something different, and it really catches my listeners' attention for sure.
Are you the only one that you know of who's doing it as an Indonesian?
I know this one guy. It's actually really funny. I did a country music special out in Indonesia last October.
Huh.
So never thought that was going to be on the books ever in my life. But I met this guy. His name is Tontowi. And I guess he's like the father of country music in Indonesia, which I didn't know people listened to that in the first place. And he reached out to me. And we actually played a show in Houston together a couple months ago. And he invited me out to Indonesia, and luckily it worked out because I was visiting family at the time, and we were on air, and truly was mind blown that I was able to merge both of my worlds together.
That's crazy. So you were in Indonesia singing country music with an Indonesian country music star?
Yes, ma'am. It definitely threw me off. Like I said, I didn't think I would add that in my books whatsoever, but you know what? It's an amazing experience. Like I said, I threw me off for sure, but they had a steel player, they had a fiddle player, and I was like, what the heck is going on? This is crazy.
That's amazing. That's amazing. You made it to American Idol, right? And made it pretty far. What was that experience like?
It was awesome. I got a lot of amazing feedback, and honestly, the thing that I kind of took away from it is finding the sound that I wanted to sing and record, but also met amazing people that I still keep in touch with today. You know, some of us have signed some record deals, and some of us are still touring and such, so it's been really amazing seeing everyone's journey post-Idol.
Yeah, it's like a cohort of you, it sounds like.
It really is. It's pretty insane.
So you've since then really built a massive following on social media, which is not, I guess, unique for someone of your generation, but you've really, you know, taken it really far. How have you used social media? How do you view that, the role of social media in what you do as an artist?
Yeah, I mean, social media nowadays is kind of like the Wild West of the music industry. I mean, I remember starting off my career itself, I didn't really want to do social media. And I've told like a lot of my friends, it was like, you got to get on social media. You got to get on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, whatever you need to do to get your voice out there. You know, nowadays it's not like going to Nashville where you cut a record and pray to God it hits radio.
Yeah.
I mean, you can really start making streams off social media itself. So I kind of focused majority of my career on that aspect of it all, just recording videos and showing off the songs that I've written. And it kind of took off at an early stage of my career. And now it's been amazing. I mean, I've gotten to meet a lot of amazing folks through social media, and it's gotten me a lot of shows. So I'm really grateful for that for sure.
But it sounds like you still kind of do the traditional thing in a lot of ways, where you're going around and playing a million shows live with your band.
Yes, ma'am. We're on the road almost every single week, whether that's 2-day show run or 3-day show run. So I've been pretty busy.
Let me ask you lastly about being from New Mexico. Like, you have said that your goal is to make a name for yourself in your home state, but to also put your home state kind of on the music map in a way. Are you surprised it isn't in that country music realm already?
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. You know, you go to different parts of New Mexico itself, and it's a night and day difference. I mean, where I'm from in Las Cruces, it's very ag-oriented. But you go up north where my fiance's from, and it's like you're in Utah or Colorado. You know, mm-hmm. I'm like the only kid that's wearing a cowboy hat. So it's kind of odd to say the least. But I mean, being from New Mexico is something that I really cherish in my heart, and I want to be able to push country music artists itself. I mean, there's a guy from my hometown. His name is Frank Gray, and I remember watching him growing up, and now he's making a name for himself as well. And you got guys like Will Ballenster, who's out in Roswell. So it's pretty cool that there are some artists from out here, and, you know, we're all kind of pushing that same country music dream. And it's been a fun journey doing that, you know, representing my home state, because there's definitely not many of us. I mean, you go to Texas, there's plentiful, you know, mm-hmm. but here from New Mexico, there's not many of us doing it. So it's been really, really fun.
I was listening to Keith Whitley when she said goodbye, and I never thought that breaking up would cross my mind.
All right. Well, lots to watch for in your career, I am sure. That is Zaki Sicarno, a country music artist from New Mexico, joining us. Zaki, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for telling us your story here. Appreciate it.
No, thank you, Lauren, for having me. It does mean a lot.
Was it something that I did? Is it someone that you met? Did I make you feel at home? Did you ever feel alone?
90s country, Sam. How do you like that?
Everything old is new again.
I know. It makes me feel old, but I'll take it.
Yeah. I'm having high school flashbacks right now.
I want to go listen to some Garth Brooks. All
there
right.
There we go.
That is it for today's edition of the show. Remember, you can always sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It's called Radio Heads at theshow.kjzz.org. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us.
I can see she made her mind and she was letting go. All the memories that we made when we were still in love. How could someone throw it all away? Just give up. It was just something that I did.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.